A specter is haunting the world.
The specter of communism.
Hello, everyone. This is Dante here from the Specter Podcast of the Communist Party USA. And today we'll be giving you a special episode, an event that we had, the Nibel Proctor Marxist Library in Oakland this past November, hosted by the Harry Bridges Club of San Francisco and the People's World. And they hosted the author of End of Policing, Alex Vitale. He's a sociology professor at Brooklyn College, and he wrote a recent work called The End of Policing, which I just mentioned. And he gave a scathing critique of police reformism and presented a realistic alternative to policing, such as restorative justice programs and harm reduction. And the book attempts to spark a public discourse by telling the racist and anti-labor origins of modern policing as a tool of social control in which police authority inconsistent with community empowerment, social justice, and public safety. Specifically in his book, he says, "The origins and function of the police are intimately tied to the management of inequalities of race and class, the suppression of workers, and the tight surveillance and micromanagement of black and brown lives have always been at the center of policing. Any police reform strategy that does not address this reality is doomed to fail." And in his work, he also goes to touch on the reformist idea of community policing, which basically focuses on police accountability, diversity, and training, and community relations, which so far have not produced any positive results, as we currently know. So, as Vitale says, the problem is not police training, police diversity, or police methods. The problem is the dramatic and unprecedented expansion and intensity of policing in the last 40 years, a fundamental shift in the role of police in society. The problem is policing itself. So just to give a quick bio of Vitale himself, as I mentioned earlier, he's a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College, and he's also a visiting professor at London South Bank University. He has spent the last 25 years writing about policing and consults both police departments and human rights organizations internationally. He also serves on the New York State Advisory Committee of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. Vitale is also an author of City of Disorder, How the Quality of Life Campaign Transformed New York Politics, and The End of Policing. His academic writings on policing have appeared in Policing and Society, Police Practice, and Research, Mobilization, and Contemporary Sociology. He's also a frequent essayist whose writings have appeared in The New York Times, New York Daily News, The Nation, Vice News, The Jacobin, and USA Today. And here we will continue with our conversation with Professor Vitale. Thank you, guys.
I'm here because I'm tired of being tired, like Fannie Lou Hamer said. Mm-hmm. I'm tired of seeing black and brown people shot in the streets, our brothers, our sisters, and no accountability on the part of the police regime in our community that inhabit and dominate our communities. So I'm tired of it. I'm really, really tired of it, and I'm looking for some answers. After 50 years, I started when I was 10. My first picket line I walked on in front of Woolworths in Detroit, Michigan. I saw some people walking around with a sign. And I asked my mom, "Mommy, what are they doing? I want to get some peanuts and candy out of Woolworths." She said, "Well, they don't allow people to go in there. Or if they go in there, they can't sit at the counter." And at that point, I said, "Well, can I go?" She said, "Go on, baby. I got your back." And I went, and that was my first picket line, and now it's 74. I'm still picketing, still complaining, still challenging the system that is a beast and a monster that's taking, sucking the life out of our young and old and everybody who they cannot, you know, who they can exploit. So that's why I'm here. Taught school in Oakland forever and a day. I just saw one of my babies today at Mosswood feeding the homeless. Her 9-year-old grandson said, "On my 9th birthday, let's raise some food and some backpacks and socks for the homeless at Mosswood." And they did. They raised enough for 150 people. So that gives me inspiration and hope. But like I said, we're living in some pretty harsh times, and I'm looking for some solutions. I know what the problems are. Let's see if we can find some solutions. That's why I'm here. All right, peace and love.
I don't usually talk about this too much when I give presentations, but it seems appropriate here to point out that I'm a fourth-generation unionist. Mm-hmm. The Tallies were coal miners in southern Illinois, going back to my great-grandfather, and they were radical union organizers. They were fighting within the United Mine Workers Union to turn it away from business unionism, and so they were part of the Progressive Mine Workers Caucus. And my father's favorite uncle, Frank, was a member of the CP, and I have some of his volumes of Marx and Lenin at home and in my personal library. So these ideas were around growing up, even where I did in Houston, Texas. So I'm really pleased to be here and honored to have this invitation, and maybe just start with a little story about actually my time here in San Francisco. For those of you who don't know, I did live in the Bay Area in the late 80s and early 90s and worked on homelessness issues, which have unfortunately only gotten worse over the last 30 years. And during that time, one of the things I was involved in, I was working at the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness that, you know, produces the street sheet, et cetera, and I was hired to do housing policy and whatnot. But there was this growing police crackdown of homeless folks, and one of the ways that I experienced that directly was that I was part of the Food Not Bombs group in San Francisco, and we were supporting what was then the homeless encampment across from City Hall, and you may remember in the late 80s. And when our very liberal mayor, Art Agnos, former social worker, opened one new multi-service center shelter, he said, well, that's it. Not going to tolerate any more public homelessness. The fact that there are more homeless people in the encampment than there are spots in the new shelter was irrelevant. Because his mindset was, these problems have to be solved within the confines of social services and the kind of a liberal approach to managing the homeless problem. And so when we said, when we pointed out that solution was inadequate, that there weren't enough spaces, and therefore people were going to have to put up with public homelessness and treat people with dignity and respect, he has arrested. So I spent a number of nights at 850 Bryant Street, and my shout out to the folks who are trying to close that horrible place at a campaign that's underway in San Francisco. But that experience caused me to really look deeply and interrogate what this liberal politics was and the fundamental contradictions and limits of that approach. And that really influenced my understanding about the nature of policing and, more importantly, the nature of police reform. And really, one of the major motivations for writing this book was frustration of watching over the decades horrible police abuses followed by community outrage that ends in hiring a couple of black police officers, having some community meetings, doing some anti-bias training, and then 5 years later, the police are back doing exactly what they've always been doing. And as a police scholar, which I've been for the last 20-something years, I knew what the research showed, that these interventions have no effect. They do not make the police nicer. They do not make the police friendlier. They do not reduce the number of abuses. They do not change the fundamental nature of policing. One of my favorites is implicit bias training, which is all the rage now. When the police are accused of racial misconduct, police leaders, mayors say, don't worry, we're going to pay $5 million to bring someone in and give them all implicit bias training. You know, implicit bias training is this idea that racial bias is kind of unavoidable and unconscious, and no one really means it. And I'm like, the first thing is, we got a problem of explicit racism in America. It's not just accidental, unintentional. Look, the text messages within the SFPD, the racist tattoos on the LA sheriff's arms, that this is not unconscious. Oops, I did a microaggression to you, I'm sorry. But the problem is even bigger than that, because even that imagines that the problems of race and policing are about the discretionary decisions of individual police officers. You know, so that maybe if we just hired more black police officers or brown police officers, they would make better individual decisions and we could just, you know, relax and everything will be fine. But of course, that's not the nature of the race problem of American policing. The race problem is built into the mission of policing. It's built into the decision to use police to manage the problems of certain communities. You know, if you live in a fancy area up in Marin and your kid gets involved with drugs, you're not calling the police. They already have police abolition up there. If their kid gets caught with drugs in school at some their fancy private school, they're not calling the police.
That's right.
Oh, Jimmy, why did you bring this to school? Give that to me. You know, maybe we'll call your parents. Why don't they call the police? Because their parents don't want them to call the police.
Right.
Why? Because they know that nothing good can come from that.
Right.
Nothing good can come from that. But when poor kids, black and brown kids, get caught with drugs or act out in school, the only thing that they'll understand is zero tolerance discipline policies, arrests, school policing, metal detectors, and all that. So the very decision to treat their problems as the kind of thing that can be solved by the police is where the racism is happening. And arguing at individual cops, as gratifying as that might feel in the moment, is not going to get us anywhere. And even putting one or two of them in jail, as just as that might feel, and as much as we see the legitimacy of the desire for that, it doesn't change policing. It's not going to get us the relief we want. Community policing. Everyone's all about community policing these days. Oh, who could be against that? You know, we want the police to understand the community, to be more respectful to the good people in the community. But the fundamental nature of community policing is that it's about the community bringing all their problems to the police to solve. But what tools do the police have to solve our community problems?
AK-47.
They got guns, and handcuffs, and ticket books, and threats, and harassment, and violence. But these are not the tools we need to solve our community problems. They don't have access to supportive housing. They don't have access to mental health care services. They don't have access to after-school, high-quality after-school programs, medically-based drug treatment. These are the kinds of things communities need to solve their problems. So every time the city says to us, the solution to your problem is more police, more incarceration, they're telling us we can't have the things that we actually need. We can have more people in cages. It's about trying to get us to accept the idea that the way we save 80% of the community is to wipe out the other 20%. And that doesn't sound like justice to me. There's no justice in that. But liberals, like Art Agnos, like the folks we got running Oakland and San Francisco today, they think the way we fix policing is just to make the police more professional, friendlier to the community, that we need to restore trust in the police. I'm here to tell you, don't trust the police. That is not how we're going to solve this problem, right? They're trying to tell us that the law is here to benefit everyone, and if we can just get the police to follow the law properly, that everybody will automatically benefit from that. But as I'm sure many of you know, the law does not benefit everyone equally. There's a famous 19th century saying, "The law in its majesty forbids both the rich and the poor from sleeping under bridges, begging in the streets, and stealing bread." But the rich don't need to do these things. And a totally lawful, professional, unbiased drug arrest is still going to ruin some person's life for no damn good reason. There's no justice in it. We do not need to give narcotics officers anti-bias training. We need to end the war on drugs.
There you go.
The war on drugs is fundamentally unjust and is at root a project of racial oppression. That was the whole point. It was never about public health. It was never about public safety. It was never even about drugs. And we've been waging this war on drugs for 50 years, and anybody can get any kind of drugs they want. No lives have been saved, and no one has been prevented from getting any drugs.
It's worse.
Yeah.
Oxycontin.
Yes, of course. Whether it's the corporations or people and, you know, looking to make money on the black market, all these forces are hurt. I do a lot of talks at colleges and high schools, and I'm like, if your grade depended upon whether you could get illegal drugs, is there anyone who'd be at risk of failing? And they, of course, they all laugh, you know, because everyone in America knows how to get drugs. Because the drug war has nothing to do with drugs. It's a tool of criminalization. And the proper enforcement of the drug laws is not the solution. It is part of the problem. So what do we do about it? What do we do about this? If we can't fix this by jailing a few killer cops or bringing in some bias training and community meetings, what are we going to do about this? We've got to push back on the idea that police are the solution to our problems. And we've got to start demanding the things that actually are the solutions to our problems. Instead of, and I know the desire to do this is so powerful, but instead of yelling at the police commission, we've got to go to the people who have the real power. The police did not invent the war on drugs. And they did not create mass homelessness. And they did not dismantle the mental health system. And they cannot fix those things. Now, they have their own ideology, and they give money to politicians, and they're certainly our political enemies, but they are not the decision makers.
That's right.
And for too long, we've given a pass to these politicians who come out on the picket line with us when somebody gets killed by the police, and then they go back to the Board of Supervisors and vote to open a new jail or to hire more cops or to cut basic services. And we can't let them get away with that anymore. And while taking the endorsement of the Police Officers Association, taking their money, those people can't be our friends anymore.
Okay.
We've got to focus on community power building around an agenda of demanding the things that we really want. Why can't we have high-quality drug treatment on demand? Why can't we have community-based anti-violence efforts that don't criminalize our children? Why can't we have more counselors and restorative justice programs in the schools? Why can't we have affordable, supportive housing for people who need it? Because all the money's going to the jail and the prisons and the police. And the richest 1% who get their tax breaks. And at the national level, of course, the military. Absolutely. To the extent that we can organize to demand these things and win them, that's great. We've won concrete things for our communities that are going to save lives and make communities better and strengthen our power and give us momentum. And to the extent that the state won't give us what we want, then we point out the fundamental injustice of that. We point out the contradictions of a government that is unwilling to provide us with the most basic things to support our humanity. A government that allows tens of thousands of people to live under underpasses is fundamentally unjust. And we have to point that out and demand the things that will really address that. And if they won't give it to us, then we need to figure out some other way of arranging these things. What that looks like, I can't say, but I'm happy to be part of the conversation of figuring that out. Thank you.
I know that you said in your book there are countries and places where they're doing better than what we're doing here. Because what we're doing here is murder, okay? So can you articulate what those countries are and what kind of programs do they have in place? Because let's say at MOSLA, okay, I'm the co-chair of a MOSLA advisory committee, and we have 129 people in camp at the park.
Damn.
There are needles everywhere.
Damn.
And the city is not, and the county are not doing what they're supposed to do to clean it up, right? They need to clean up the needles. They need to take out the garbage. They need to do a whole bunch of stuff. But what happens in the community, people get riled up. They say, I can't bring my kid to the park no more.
That's right.
They said the people in the encampment are the problem, and that's not a place for people to live. So my question was, if they can't live in the park, where in the hell can they live? Well, the park wasn't designed for the homeless. I said, neither are the underpass, the sidewalks, the empty cars that people have to live in. I mean, come on now. So how do you bridge that kind of gap? And just one other thing, they wanted to, they said, well, the homeless come back. Of course, no place to go, right?
Yep.
So they said, well, maybe they should give them tickets. Or maybe they need to start incarcerating the homeless. I said, what? You know, and then they wanted to put a police station in Montswood.
Oh.
He said, hell no, we're not going to do it. Matter of fact, there's going to be a mark on the 23rd of budget coming from Marshall Housing. But, yeah, so
yep.
What are the approaches that are being used, and how can we work with these advantages in the community?
So I think it's part of the reason why even our liberal friends are part of the problem is that they have totally capitulated to austerity. And so they have bought into the idea that the only way to keep the city afloat is to turn the keys over to high finance and real estate and cut services and accept the logic that there's nothing that the city and the state can do to intervene in markets. So we can't intervene in real estate markets, we can't intervene in labor markets, except in these little marginal ways. So what that means is that for 40 years, communities have been told the only state resource they can have is the police. So that when a problem like people living in the park is out of control, people ask for more police because they've been told that's the only thing they can have. And part of what we've got to do is break that mindset. Because at the root of this is the problem that the austerity folks, to keep their ship sailing, it's really important that they define every social problem as being the result of individual and group moral failure that will only respond to punitive interventions. And that's how they divert us from talking about housing markets and labor markets and what the state could really be doing to help us. So it's really tough. And this is a transition into the other part to help answer the first part, which is that we can't say to communities, well, there's nothing we can do till the revolution. Because what that does, and this is kind of the topic of my earlier book, City of Disorder, is what that does is it drives people into the arms of the right wing. That's how you get Giuliani in New York. That's how you got Frank Jordan in San Francisco, who was the chief of police, and the anger about the level of disorder drove people to the right. So we've got to be able to talk to people about things that can be done now while we build for the things that we really want. And we have examples. And in the book, I take, you know, 8 areas of policing and talk about what a bad idea they are, how much harm they cause, why the solutions we usually hear are dead end, and then what we could really be doing. But those what we could be really doing things have to be sort of immediate, intermediate, and long term, and we've got to kind of pursue them all at the same time. So we can look, like at the drugs question, at a place like Portugal. So Portugal has decriminalized all drugs.
Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Civilization has not collapsed. It's okay. It's okay. The health outcomes are better, overdoses are down, HIV infection rates are down. Yes, people are still using drugs in harmful ways, but it's not the end of the world. And it has created space. The pulling the police out of the drug business is actually reducing the harms and giving the state other tools like public health messaging, increased funds for drug treatment. So while we work on even bigger transformations, like why do so many people turn to drugs in the first place, while we work on that, we can provide some immediate relief. So I'm a big supporter, you know, of marijuana legalization. But when the big presidential candidates say they want to end the drugs and they stop the conversation of marijuana, I'm like, hello, that is not the only drug that we need to legalize. We've got to go for all of it. In New Zealand, they have decriminalized and legalized sex work. And in parts of Australia and parts of Brazil, Mexico, there are a lot of places. I'm not talking about the Nordic model where they don't arrest the women, but they do arrest the men. Yeah. That's not what I'm talking. This is full decriminalization. People can open legitimate businesses, advertise. Yeah, well, it's a business, and they are workers, and they should have the same rights and protections as any other workers. And so much of the harm, so much of the harm that these workers experience is directly related to the criminalization.
Yes, that's true.
From the police, from people who try to control them, from Johns who can abuse them, because they don't have any legal protection. So we can talk to community. Yes, we see that this stroll is a source of disorder and discomfort for you, and we can't totally ignore that. But we can say the solution to that is not criminalization. It's a form of legalization. And I don't mean the hyper-restrictive micromanagement legalization. I mean the ability to openly practice this trade, which would overwhelmingly move it indoors, into better regulated workplaces with basic health and safety protections and the right to self-organize, etc. You know, if you go to a place and they make you scan your ID in the Xerox machine before you purchase services, then there's not going to be violence against the sex workers. But you can't do that now, because who wants to give their ID over to an illegal business where they're going to have, where the police raid comes, here's your ID, right? So it's just basic. We got to get it out of the black market. You know, homelessness has become so out of control that it is very hard to come up with these kinds of intermediate mitigation steps. But we do have the, you know, we need to talk to communities concretely in the context of community organizing about what exactly is the most pressing issue about the homelessness situation for you. Is it garbage? Is it the physical condition of people? What can, well, maybe we need a 24-hour sobering center where people can go. Maybe we need to open up proper community bathrooms that are staffed. so that people can take care of their personal hygiene needs without it becoming a public problem. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we do need to take over some parking lots and other spaces and turn them into temporary tent cities where we can work with people, build power while we work on the long-term housing thing, because we cannot solve the housing problem overnight, even if we wanted to. We can't build that many units in a year. It's going to take time. So these are examples, and I try to give those kinds of examples in every chapter of the book.
Okay.
Good. This is supposed to be a conversation. So at the age, I'm talking about children now, right? So at the age of 5, I was in kindergarten. I had a teacher named Miss Coyne. We loved her. She taught there 40 years of kindergarten. And she brought in the police. And, you know, we're fine, right? And so you're looking at the police, you see this shiny badge, and you think, oh, these are good guys, right? There were no women in those days anyway, the police force. But by the time I was 10, I was scared. There was a guy called Rotation Slim. He's a white guy. He was about 6'4", and he was known for beating black ass. And everybody, I mean, and so there was a terror in the community. So my question, or maybe it's just a statement, the terror that we feel. Today, we were doing a thing at Mosswood. One of my students, Mitzi, came to me, and she's now about 40. And she says, this is my granddaughter. She's the daughter of my son that was murdered. You know what I mean? It's just like, so how do we, number one, protect our children and ourselves so that we have some kind of peace? Because right now, there's not a lot of peace in the community. And one last thing is this assistant who lives on my block. She owns property, okay? But she's sort of out of her mind. And she threatens everybody. And she runs down the street and they take her away from 2 or 3 days, and she comes back, and the police had her on the ground in handcuffs. So, like, how do we deal with these kind of situations? And I can answer these questions, maybe other people out here, because I know for a fact it's the system that we live in.
That's right.
It's an arm of the state, of the capitalist state, that takes and take the lifeblood out of everybody that they can exploit. So I know this for sure, but in the interim, how do we deal with this? Our children.
Yeah, because we're all affected by the system. We sometimes hear, well, we need to give leadership to those most directly affected, and it's important. They have to play an important role in our movements, but sometimes we lose track of the fact that we're all affected by this system. You know, some people benefit more than others, and some people are hurt more than others, but when we lose track of that way in which this is a system that affects all of us, then we can get off track. We can start talking about reforms to make the prisons a little nicer for those most directly affected without changing the fundamental nature of using cages to control people. School policing. You know, school policing started with elementary schools. And that's often how they get started. And obviously that's not because that's where the violence is. It's because the point is to teach kids respect for authority. To see that shiny badge and that crisp uniform, and to look on those police as their protectors and saviors. And that this process begins in the 1950s, in the era of kind of juvenile delinquency and the blackboard jungle kind of thing. And they're like, these high school kids are out of control. What are we going to do about that? We're going to put police in the elementary school so we can get them when they're young and teach them to respect authority. We don't need nicer school police. We don't need school police to be counselors and mentors. We don't need them to be better trained. We need to get rid of school police. It's a terrible idea. The research shows that the schools they're in are no safer, that in fact the kids feel less secure. They don't prevent school shootings. There were armed police in Columbine. There were armed police in Parkland.
It
made no difference. We have to actually treat our kids with dignity and respect and address the needs that they have, many of which they bring with them from problems at home in the community, and we've got to address those things. So I was in Salinas in the Central Valley earlier this year, and they've been doing some of this community organizing to demand the things they really want. When the police department said, oh, well, we went to the federal government and they gave us like $80 million for school police, and if we don't use it by the end of the month, we're going to lose it, so let's just have a big school policing program. And they were like, no way. Because they were already organized, they were able to go to the Board of Education. They use a different term, I forget what it is, but you get the idea. And they brought so much public pressure to bear that the education department said, no, we don't want it. We don't care that it's free money. We don't want police. And this was to put police in the elementary school.
So why don't we open up to the floor? We're having a conversation, but I could have a conversation with him after. Why don't we open up to the floor and let's see the hands. One, two, three. Let's the first three, then
That's my favorite button. I love that. I used to have that poster on my wall.
Lisinski.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Thank you for your presentation. I had the opportunity to go through your book, not thoroughly. I wanted to get your thoughts on the recent victory in San Francisco in the district attorney's office. And the fact that the Police Officers Association gave gags of money
hundreds
to the opposition. And a lot of it came from outstanding. And it came from other police officer associations. So here's Loftus, backed up by the power elite in San Francisco. And here's Chesapeake Levine. He won the election, but it's a narrow victory. And I read some of his program. I'm not currently a member of voting. I don't vote in San Francisco.
Yeah.
But I did read his program. I'm familiar with what he's done. I wonder what your thoughts on what it sort of shows in terms of San Francisco.
Great. And so this is not a San Francisco specific question, really. I mean, this is a national movement. I'm close to Tiffany Caban, who ran in Queens and lost by the same sort of margin that Chase won by. You know, it was very, very close and really disappointing. But I set a very high bar on this. I think that progressive prosecutors can be part of the solution. They can act as a kind of harm reduction, help us to dismantle some of these systems. But they don't have a lot of power to do the community development empowerment that's ultimately what we need. So this is not the end goal solution. This is part of the process. Chase's platform was contained some core good elements about bail, etc. There were things that were missing in my mind, but I think that they actually want to do, and they have reached out to me. I am scheduled to talk with them about some things. So, and I, you know, speak to Krasner's folks in Philadelphia, and other, you know, so I do try to help this movement with some of these ideas about how can these prosecutors help us at the community level. Not after someone gets arrested, not after they're in court, but before. Right. And part of this involves things like using asset forfeiture money or money that comes from like prosecuting banks and landlords and directing that into community needs. Mm-hmm. And so that's the kind of advice that I've been giving to these prosecutors.
Okay.
Another two questions? Yeah. Okay.
Do I need the mic? This is, well, I think kind of small, but I'm glad Cassie brought up the bringing the police into the kindergarten. You know, as I think there's a huge subtle and not so subtle entertainment propaganda machine. I mean, I don't own a television, but you know, I looked at all the police programs and all the other great guys and stuff. But I do, I have a 2-year-old granddaughter, and I'm sitting on the couch with her at her parents' house, and we're looking at Paw Patrol. Yeah, you know, this doggy cartoon thing. And they all have badges. They're all the good guys with the helmets and the, you know, and the vehicles that can fly around and rescue this and rescue that. I mean, they're programming 1- and 2-year-olds.
Yes, they are.
And I just wanted to
Propaganda. I want to recommend a podcast to you called Running from Cops, which is a multi-part podcast about the television show Cops, which is one of the longest-running shows in television history, and it is on 24/7. If you just flip through enough of the 800 channels, you'll find an episode of Cops or Stories of the Highway Patrol or real-life adventures of fish and game wardens. It really is like A&E is just 24 hours a day of live PD because they just run the reruns. Anyway, this is incredibly damaging and is co-produced by police. Co-produced?
Yes.
As were the early television dramas.
Yes.
I grew up on Adam 12. And at the end of every episode, you know, made with the cooperation of the office of Chief Parker, and, you know, LA. And when did that come on? 1967. Why? In the wake of the Watts riots. What was the message? The police are professional. We just want the facts. We follow the rules. We're not racist. It's okay. You can trust us. We're here to help. It was propaganda. And so that is what we get 24/7, both the fictional and the non-fictional stuff. And it's very hard to, you know, my students come in, that's what they know about policing, a lot of them. Not the ones who come from poor communities, black, they actually have first-hand knowledge of what policing is, but the better-off students, the white students, they, all they know is what they see on TV at these shows. It's like deprogramming.
Number 3,
right? Two part. One, I work in the criminal justice system, and I spend a lot of my time around cops and criminal defense. One part, I get a number of cases where I'll get someone who called the cops because their partner is drunk, and basically all they wanted was to throw him or her in the drunk tank, sober up for 24 hours, and then be released. Obviously, that's not how it works. But on one level, that is what people want or expect of police. How is it possible to deal with that sort of issue within a community, or how is it possible to make cops do that? And the other side of that is, I do a lot of cases in Bayview and Hunter's Point, and people do kill each other. And the question is, how are those cases investigated? And how do you deal with that level of violence, which we know it has many different causes, but in the immediate term, what do you do with that?
That's right.
Okay, so sometimes when someone calls, you know, the person who calls is the one who ends up getting arrested, right? Because they're like, no, I don't want you to arrest him, and then they get into it with the cops, and now it's disorderly conduct, obstructing government, they both arrest him. And I would say an even bigger problem is how domestic violence is handled. Right? There's a fantastic new book out called Decriminalizing Domestic Violence, and what it says is, and this is written by a woman who spent like 20 years in the legal system representing victims of domestic violence, and she said the courts, the cops, never helped anybody. Never got better for anybody. The Violence Against Women Act turned the problem of domestic violence over to cops and courts and set us back a generation.
Great book.
It's really good. She at the very end, she hedges and she says, I'm not sure we should actually completely decriminalize this, but I spoke to her this week and she says she regrets it. She now feels that, yes, we should completely get the criminal legal system out of domestic violence. So what do we do instead? This is the question, right? What do we do instead? So there are a few things. First is, there's what can we can do as individuals. There, one example is there's a thing called pod mapping. I don't know where the name comes from, but they do trainings in communities where they work with people to identify the personal resources they have, family, friends, etc., who they might be able to call on in a crisis, a mental health crisis, an overdose, a domestic violence situation, and also what community resources exist that could maybe be utilized, hopefully preventatively, but possibly even in a crisis, so that people have thought ahead of time about some alternative strategies. But really, we need other kinds of resources that don't exist yet. We can't solve all these problems just with our friends and neighbors. Some things we can, you know, if those kids on the corner are making a mess and making, then get a few neighbors together and go talk to them. Or frankly, why don't you know any of those kids, right? So that you can actually say, Jimmy, come on, we're trying to sleep. Let's talk about this tomorrow, you know, so that there's a respectful dialogue, not I'm going to anonymously call the police on you because I'm afraid of you, I don't know you, I don't bother to, you know, connect with anyone in the community, right? So it's about community building. But we need also some other kind of robust crisis response to be available. So a lot of communities are working on this in relationship to mental health calls. We've got a major campaign getting underway in New York to create a completely non-police crisis response capability 24/7. Between a quarter and a half of all people killed by police in the United States are having a mental health crisis. And the police should not have anything to do with it. So that's the kind of thing we got to develop, is the ability to have people who have special training but aren't focused on carrying guns around to solve problems. On the homicide thing, so there are different causes of homicide. Are we talking about domestic violence? Are we talking about youth gangs? Are we talking about armed robberies gone bad? So those things matter because the strategies for each are going to be different. I have a chapter in the book about youth violence, gangs. That's a real violence problem, but we have community-based strategies to deal with that. Keeping in mind that the police exist and kids are still killing each other. So it's not like the police have solved this problem. Clearance rates are terrible in these cases. They're not catching people. So no system is going to be perfect, but community-based anti-violence strategies using credible messengers and public health responses and trauma counseling don't come with the baggage of mass incarceration. They treat kids with respect and dignity and try to figure out what we can do to work this out, to deal with the history of trauma that is always, always present in these cases. No kid who's out shooting someone has not themselves been the victim of violence.
Yep.
Every single case. And so what are we doing to break that cycle? One of the programs I like is based in a trauma care hospital. And when kids come in with gunshot wounds and stab wounds, they're assigned a caseworker who is someone from their community who themselves had been shot or stabbed when they were younger, to go in and work with that young person, to try to break that cycle of violence. Because, you know, Jimmy gets shot, and then Jimmy's brother goes and gets that guy, and then that guy's cousin goes and gets that guy, right? That's how these beefs escalate and keep running.
30 years later.
Yeah, so we got to get in there and break that cycle. But we don't do it through criminalization.
I have a statement and a question. My first question is, actually I have two questions. What is your thought on policing not just police, but have police having insurance on their guns, as far as it being a solution. The second is your thought on policing living in the communities that they're patrolling in. But I do want to bring on, touch on something, because, you know, as I'm looking in the audience, you know, we can all agree that, number one, we all know that there needs to be a solution to this problem. There's not going to be a solution overnight. But for someone like myself, a dark-skinned black male, for someone like myself who, in the age of social media, every day, I'm seeing videos of police not just physically abusing people of all ages. You know, you talk about policing in the school. There was a video last week of a policeman manhandling an 11-year-old girl. Then there was a video of a policeman, you know, pulling over someone, and after that person being compliant, they're snatched out of their car through a broken glass window. Then there was another video. So these videos that are constantly being repeated. So it's almost like a catch-22, because here we are trying to find solutions, especially someone like myself who's more likely to just be stopped just from walking on the street. And someone growing up in Oakland who's had police come in my house, been in handcuffs, stopped and questioned, witnessed through Cassie, had police running in out of their house. So not just the level of trauma that comes with that, but also what can a person do at this point in time? Because there, I mean, it's almost like to say that there's really nothing you can do at this point. And we all know that police are out of control. Let's just call it for what it is. But again, like I said, as I'm looking at this audience, it's almost like that this audience, that this conversation needs to happen with people of my age range and black men of my color, because it's like, what can we do now? Like Colin Kaepernick posted something down at the Open Hub where he educated young black men on this is how you conduct yourself in front of police. Now, these conversations aren't only going to go so far, because then you get someone, you also have police officers who come out of the military and ready, are very gung-ho police that are extremely racist and have backgrounds and ties to extremist groups, you know? So it's, I'm going to be frank, like for me, this conversation to some degree sounds repetitive, because it's like, okay, what can I do when in that situation? What can I do when I'm looking at these things? I can only go to so many demonstrations to the point where I crack. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. So first, I want to say that we're not going to win these things until we build multiracial power. But we can't build multiracial power unless it's led by black and brown people. That's my view about that. But they can't do it by themselves or in isolation from each other. So we have to find some way to figure this out. And it's not easy. And I spent a lot of time working in partnership with these kinds of communities and with other scholars and activists of different racial groups. There is a movement that is trying to figure this out. So I encourage you to try to not watch so many of those videos. We know that they're traumatizing, that they are affecting people, that they have health consequences for people. So we need to be aware of what's going on, but I really encourage you to try not to watch all those videos, especially as a black man. I mean that in a really genuine sense. It's harmful, and I'm not telling you not to pay attention. I'm telling you to really respect that this has a really bad effect on people. And it is part of the point of what the police do, is to have this effect on people. So we need to figure out how to protect ourselves from that in some way. So is the solution, you know, personal liability insurance for police officers? This is a favorite of the kind of libertarian crowd, this imagining that we can use market forces to fix policing. And this is a dead end, right? That the problem is that as soon as officers start getting successfully sued and having to pay damages, they will just demand that they be re-immunized. They will use their power to get insulated from that. Yeah. I don't really see a political world where the state is going to use its political capital to allow police officers to suffer individual damages. The amount of political capital it would take to achieve that would be much better spent in other ways, like demanding real solutions to our community problems. And I really, in a way, I'm not trying to get people to go to more demonstrations against the cops. That's really not what I'm saying. That is not the solution. Yes, we need to point out the harms that policing and jails and courts cause to people. We need to be knowledgeable about those things because we're trying to dismantle them. But our focus has got to be on mobilizing community power for what we really want. And arguing over this liability insurance or body cameras or, you know, a new civilian, new form of even better civilian review board, these things don't work. They have never worked, and they're not gonna work. And that's just the sad reality, because those things all rest on this idea that the problem is a few bad apples. But the police are doing exactly what they've been asked to do. We have to make them do something else, which is as little as possible.
Okay, who was next? Sharon, was
yes.
You next?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's get it real quick. Next to Sharon is you, and then Jill. Okay, Jill?
Okay. I wanted to remind us that it's not just cops on the beat, city cops, but it's also the sheriff system, which needs to be abolished. And I didn't used to call myself an abolitionist. I used to think that, you know, oh, that's pie in the sky. We'll only get there when we have a socialism. But I don't think that anymore. I think it's one of the most important reforms that we can fight for on the way to building a revolutionary movement. And there are 3,000 sheriffs in this country, and each one of them has a force of many hundreds of deputies. And in addition to patrolling, doing a lot of patrolling, they run the county jails, which, in my opinion, are really places filled with people who need mental health care who aren't getting it. And so what we need to do is redefine what, you know, taking someone into custody for having a problem really means. And if they need mental health care, that's what they should get. And we should abolish the sheriff system, period.
Okay, the next person. Thank you, Sharon.
Yeah, thank you very much. I agree with Sharon. That was also related to my question. I have two questions. One is, what are other examples internationally that we can look to, you know, in terms of dealing with this issue? The other has to do with the sheriff. The sheriff does hold a lot of power in Alameda County. I work for the county, so I know a little bit on the inside what the role that the sheriff department plays, especially in the terms of an emergency situation. They are in charge. The CAO is not in charge. The sheriff will be, the county administrator's office is not in charge. It's the sheriff. It will be in charge of Alameda County in the event of an earthquake. They will be bringing the military in. It will become a military situation if the situation with the earthquake is so bad. So I think this is something to be really concerned about in terms of the bigger picture of, in terms of our county, which is covers all 14 cities and unincorporated areas in Alameda County, and that this needs to be addressed. Also about how the sheriff gets appointed. And I think that there used to be that anybody could become a sheriff, but then, maybe Sharon knows a little bit about this, that law was changed.
Now they have to be law enforcement.
Now they have to be law enforcement to be a sheriff. So anyway, just want to put that out. And then my question is also international, what's going on?
Okay, and then, Jerry, you want to ask your question, then you'll
take
all those questions.
A couple once
again.
Okay.
Okay, is it Vitale? Did I pronounce it right?
Yeah, Vitale.
Vitale, okay. I kind of, you know, I read this problem. I tend to agree with most of what you said in your dismissing all of these cosmetic bourgeois reforms, attempts at reforms of the police. That's
true.
But I have to say, as a member of the Oscar Grant Committee Against Police Brutality and State Repression now since 2009, before that, one of the founders of Berkeley Cop Watch, before that, member of the Black Panther Party, before that, I was in NAACP, other stuff. So I've been around this too long. And that's why I know that much of what you said is true. So, but having said that, I'm a little critical, and I want you to see this, and I want you to return the critical evaluation of what I have to say. I want to be careful about saying, for instance, that nothing can be done, because my community is constantly in rebellion, fighting this police, this overt, crazed, openly racist police brutality. What the Oscar Grant Committee, we, our history, it's all out there, organizing the marches, going on the goddamn freeway until that girl got killed. Then that's it with that bullshit. That's enough of that. But, we did, in our marches that we organized, people was breaking windows and shit. And that kind of put us off, because people know that we try to be rational and intelligent in our attempts to provide solutions. Where we landed was that, in fact, a lot of the so-called left was wrong in its approach to police brutality work, because we have to draw in the working people. If we don't draw the working people into this work, then what is it? Then you're just doing it to just, satisfy yourself. So we organized a strike one day, strike in, when they was trying to let Mesley go. We got the longshoremen, the carpenters, the black BART workers, all the men, no, he should be indicted, and he got to go. The fact of the matter is that there is positive work that I think you're right when you say that overwhelmingly what we demand of these people is stop. Stop killing us. Stop lying. Stop. Yes, it's negative. But we do demand, for instance, investigations and help to craft legislation for investigations. So, for instance, as a result of our work in Richmond, we got the city council drew up a law that anytime a citizen gets shot, it immediately goes... They have to hire an independent investigator to look, because the cops got caught lying. We caught the cops lying. They said the PD tried to take the police gun. We went to the people. We got 6 witnesses and 3 tapes that showed that that was not true. Same thing with Terry Amos. Now, all of a sudden, we meet with the DA, Diane Becton, and we say, we expect an indictment on this and Terry Amos. Well, once again, when the police wrote the report, they were lying, and they said he tried to go for his gun. Well, they didn't know we was going to get to watch the report. So, for example, excuse me if I stand up a minute. I'm going to try to cut it short.
Wrap it up then.
Okay, let me wrap it up. Let me say this. We went to Sacramento for 3 years with the community and other people to get 1421 passed, and I think that was a good thing that we did. So I don't accept that there's nothing you can do. There is something you can do. You find a way to have a positive impact. That law, in turn, made the pigs open up their books, and then we catching all these goddamn lies. So they said Terry Amos was going for his gun. Well, that's a lie. We saw the tape. Looking at the tape, you're right. It's horrible. I've seen too many of them. But it is useful to show the disingenuous, the lies of the pigs with this stuff, and show that to the community to raise their consciousness and let them know. So what we did, we've done that, and I happen to think that we do want to call for independent investigations. I don't think that necessarily is a harmful thing to work for. You may not agree, and I'd like to know what you think about it.
Yeah. So let me just address a couple of international things real quick. In the UK, if someone's having a mental health crisis, they call the National Health Service hotline.
That's right.
They get a mental health nurse who has their medical records, because
they have national health insurance, right? And nobody gets killed. Here's the thing that the Swiss and the Cubans share. They have a great record on policing homeless. Why? Because they don't have any homeless people. So there's no harassment of homeless people. There's no abuse of homeless people. There's no killing homeless people because they don't have any homeless people. And that's really where we got to think. Right? So this is such a hard conversation to have, right? Because what the police are doing is so incredibly unjust. Their abuse and brutality is undeniable. And we want some justice. And we want their behavior to change. We want people to be held accountable.
Yes, that's the point.
But it doesn't make policing any better. This is the sad, sad reality. They indicted that cop and sent him to jail for murder in Chicago last year, and everyone was very happy, big victory. Ain't nobody in Chicago saying how great the police are now.
That's right.
That wasn't the point.
Okay, but what I'm trying to say is we've got to be strategic. Now, organizing around police brutality is important. That is a way we bring people into our movements and build power. And we've got to always point out how that system abuses us. But that cannot be the end of the conversation. And I don't think changing a couple words around use of force or bringing in independent prosecutors is going to make policing better or make our communities better. I just don't think so. So it's not to say that there's not organizing to be done, but we have to push the analysis. So my friend Clarence Taylor is an African-American historian in New York. He wrote a book about the history of black freedom movements in relationship to the NYPD. And he talks about the role of the CP and other kinds of black nationalist movements, etc. And he gives this, he shows how these movements have this deep analysis of how policing is an extension of colonialism and slavery, that it is at its, and I talk about all this in my book as well, that it's at root a completely unjust institution. And then they have a big community meeting and they call for, you know, a civilian oversight board. And I'm like, that is not the logical, that doesn't flow logically from your analysis. You have the right analysis, you understand the problem, but that is not the solution. So I challenge you, because you have the analysis, you know how fundamentally unjust that system is, how we don't need to fix it. So we got to have demands that reflect the depth of that analysis, which means we have to get them out of our lives, not make them nicer and more professional. They're not going to be nicer. When we tell them to wage a war on crime, a war on gangs, a war on immigrants, a war on drugs, a war on terrorism, they are not going to be nice. They're not going to be respectful. They're going to kill us. When push comes to shove, they're going to kill us. It doesn't matter what prosecutor is in place and what kind of training they've had. When their bosses say, get those kids off the corner, they're going to get those kids off the corner. And if those kids talk back to them, they're going to get beat up. And it doesn't matter who the prosecutor is. That's my view.
Barry?
I think the only way we begin to solve this problem is looking, as you suggested, is globally. For instance, in Oakland, we're seeing gentrification where people are moved out. We're seeing, I'm 77, when I was young, there were no homeless. And now we've seen an incredible surge of homeless. The police have a role to play. They are there to protect property. They're there to uphold the status quo of power. And so if we deal with this, there has to be not only a statewide analysis of strategically how we begin to impact this, but we have to look economically throughout the country. We've got some interesting candidates running now, and I think a whole different generation that's not accepting some of the premise. But if we stay focused on the police, then we can be consumed with a war of attrition on terms of resources. So I think we certainly have to do that. There's some interesting legislation in California now just beginning to readdress Prop 13, which was one of the most vicious takeaways from working people. And now there's going to be a ballot measure, which Jarvis Gann and money from the Kochs and others are going to bring in. That's part of this same discussion. And without the resources and without the money and without addressing the real underlying problems that give way to, quote, crime, you know, which is a fallacy in a lot, in most cases anyway, in terms of what is a criminal act and what isn't. I did find interesting, and I don't know enough about it, but the person in San Francisco that ran and won for the DA, in decriminalizing, I think you're beginning to deal again with some of the immediate effects. But I think that we've got to look and hope and work for some global solutions that are much broader than merely just the police.
Hi. So with the discussion of everything becoming global, I do think it is important, one, to just acknowledge that the U.S. has a very different history with race and class that other countries do not have. Also, just because another country did it, it doesn't mean it's a great solution. For example, in New Zealand, with the decriminalization, migrant women of color were completely put under the bus. And for the benefit of white sex workers. So it's not always a solution. Also, we have in this country intentional propaganda and misinformation around race and class to perpetuate the status quo and the powers at be. And that information is what created the police department, but it's also what created the government and like the Department of Health. I mean, it's all like, the problems that we have in the police department are not isolated to the police department, and I think it's worth discussing or mentioning or questioning this movement, for example, with caseworkers, and I think that that sounds great, but it's also worth noting that, like, part of my childhood conditioning was that if somebody with a notebook shows up, you lie, you know, like, you don't talk to them because you can't trust them. So if we're moving things away from police officers into another system, because we still need to fix these issues, yes, but these issues exist because of, I mean, multiple reasons, but also because of extreme misinformation and propaganda. I mean, most people don't even know about Bacon's Rebellion and things like that. So if we have these conversations and we just think that the solution is like take away the police, I think that falls extremely short and is like very dangerous, because it leaves the door open for recreating the same exact problem we have now, just with a different name.
Shall I respond
to
those two? So I'm not for just taking away the police. I'm extremely clear about that everywhere I go. That is not the strategy. That is a kind of a fantasy land strategy that we're just going to flip some switch and there are no police. This is a project about building power to demand what we really want. This is not about just imagine a world without police. This is about dismantling racial capitalism. Really, this is, but we do that, we can't do that by just being angry at the police. Because you know, when people go and argue at the police commission meeting, that meeting is designed to take all that community anger and do absolutely nothing with it. That's the whole point of that process, is to dissipate community anger, because they can't actually give us anything we really want. We let the people who actually have power off the hook. That's the tension here, right? Because we're so angry at them because they are the immediate oppressors, but they are just a tool to empower regimes of exploitation. What are we doing to go after those regimes of exploitation? Now is the time. We're in a moment, right? We're in a moment right now. Now is the time to ask for what we really want, not just what we think we can get. I think that's really important. And yes, different examples should not be taken uncritically and as whole cloth. These are intermediate strategies. They're things we can use to build power while we... And yes, not every example should be just imported as is, but it's to say that we don't have to wait till the revolution to fix everything. In fact, we'll never get to the revolution if we don't build power as we go in ways that provide concrete benefits to people.
We've talked a number of times about integrating these fights that we're having on the ground for more mental health, for more housing. I think we all agree that the function of the police is to keep the working class down, right? It's to keep the ruling class in power. That's why the police exist. And all of the problems that we're having are ultimately going to be only solved by revolution. And that's a violent business. That, you know, they're not going to give up that without some force. So the trick is that, as Alex said, it's how to integrate these day-by-day fights and bear in mind that it has to be part of a revolutionary fight.
That's not free.
It's not easy, but we need to do it.
Okay. Who's number two? All right, number two.
First of all, thank you for the presentation, and also I appreciate what you are saying. We have to understand why police exists. And like you said, it is not because violence that comes from us. But we are all, our communities are the enemy of the state because we are workers. No matter what you do, even if you were the angel on earth, you are still the enemy. Because they're going to come and take and take and take away from you. The minute you protest this, you have become the enemy. It doesn't have to be mental health. It doesn't have to be the kids on the corner. But because you try to exercise your rights as human beings, then the police comes in. I have seen many, many places where the police comes in for gentrification. They are destroying the buildings that people live on. And the minute they try to say no, they are taken away. Okay, so we have to understand the position of this. And one other thing is that my experience from another country is that when the society starts to break down in revolutionary upheaval, we may expect to see changes in the police. I have seen and worked with a revolutionary police organization. I know this is really weird, but police themselves break down for the police that's on the part of the people and the police who's on part of the capitalists. And we may see that, but we have to put the groundwork on why the police exists and why they are attacking us. It is not because of our violence, but because they have to. The state will not exist a day without having the police. So we have to choose our sides.
Quick question. So just, I live in the Golden Gate neighborhood in Oakland, and I just had a question, I guess, for particularly the local folks. You know, as a white person who lives in Oakland, I just wanted to, you know, ask, are there particular ways that I can be showing up in a better way, you know, given the fact that we know that police are, you know, a racist institution? How do we, at the individual level, I know that we can, you know, show up at rallies and protests and make demands of politicians, but day to day, are there resources that I could be utilizing that, you know, alternatives to calling 911, for example? What are some ways that I can show up and that this community can show up, you know, to combat this together, I guess, at the local level.
Well, there's going to be a march on the 23rd called By Ace, leading from Mosswood, where there's a huge homeless encampment, and it's going to be a march through Oakland. And that's one way we can do it. Another way is to work on the local needs. Like, for example, at Mosswood, we're going to redesign the whole park. But we need citizens in there saying, oh, we need this. We need the youth in there saying we need that. We need the artists and we need that. We need people to come forward. So, like, if you live in Oakland, North Oakland, come be part of Mosswood Advisory. And a lot of people say, oh, advisory. Yeah, but we're advising about the future of a resource that our community needs. So that's the way I approach it, but that would be great to see some new and young faces working on local issues.
Hi everybody, my name is Riley. Hi everyone, my name is Lena. And we are organizers with the Oakland chapter of IWOC, which is the Incarcerated Workers Organizing. Organizing the jail support program at Santa Rita, and have been involved in supporting the strike that happened 2 weeks ago. So we just wanted to give a short update on what's happening on the inside, what the outside response has been, and just our thoughts on how folks can support and what we've been doing related to that. So Lena's going to start with giving a summary of how the strike started and what was happening, and then I'm going to kind of give an overview of the current situation and what things are looking like moving forward. We'll try to keep this short.
Yeah, we know that people have a lot of questions, and Riley has some important updates for you, so I'll try to keep it brief. But we just wanted to say a few words about this strike. It was a hunger strike and work stoppage at Santa Rita that began on October 31st, and it continued into the following, at least Tuesday. And ultimately, people did call off the strike because of some health concerns that were facing people inside who were on strike. And so, as many of us here know, Santa Rita is the fifth largest jail in the United States. It's six times smaller than Los Angeles County, but it has a 50% higher rate of deaths.
Is it a jail or prison?
A jail.
County Santa Rita Jail. It's in Dublin.
No, I know it's Dublin.
Yeah. And so the rate of deaths in Santa Rita is 13.6 people per 1,000 people. And in LA County, which is much, much larger, it's 8.9 deaths per 1,000 people.
Terrible.
And in Santa Rita, 9 people alone have died this year. And sorry, again, trying to keep this brief, but I think it's important to note that that doesn't include deaths that occur outside the facility, so in a hospital, but were caused by abuse by guards, by the terrible conditions inside. Those aren't counted as in custody deaths. So simultaneously, while people are dying, while these conditions are so terrible, the budget of the sheriff's office has increased drastically with very little oversight. And in fact, we were at the Board of Supervisors, the public protection meeting, and the board told advocates who came to the meeting that they don't have the power to influence the budget, and that that community advocates should just wait for a lawsuit. And we think that that's not adequate, that we should wait for a lawsuit to govern the way that the sheriff uses the money that's given to him, the way he handles conditions in Santa Rita. And so, yeah, and the budget is...
it's like $460 million a year right now, so almost half a billion. That's only for Alameda County.
Yeah, and the sheriff's office also gets federal, they've applied for and received federal funding, like the community-oriented policing COPS grants, which were awarded in 2017. And Alameda County was one of the few counties in California to apply for it, because it specifically rewards counties who are willing to work with immigration and customs enforcement. So ultimately, we could talk for a long time about all of these things, the enormous budget. But I think it's important because we're talking about the strike to talk about the things that people inside are experiencing directly and how they are advocating for themselves. And so people inside are struggling with poor sanitation. There, people are suffering from addiction and mental health issues that remain completely unaddressed by the jail, and they receive no care for it, and they have no cleaning supplies or sanitation, and so their people are forced to help people who are detoxing, who are suffering, and they have to do that care in their cells because the jail refuses to provide that level of care. And people are also subjected to extremely high prices for food, and it should be noted that the jail food itself is often served in unsanitary plates on dirty trays, and so people have no alternative but to buy extremely expensive food that produces up to 400% profit for the jail. And so it's under these conditions that people said enough is enough, and they organized a strike in which they demanded solutions to all of these things. They are demanding things that are ultimately completely reasonable to expect, and so we think that it's just unconscionable that the jail is trying to suppress word of the strike, is retaliating against people who went on strike by firing them from their jobs. Mm-hmm. It threatens to give people 30 days additional time onto their sentences if they participated in the strike. And it was through public pressure, which Riley can expand on a little bit, that we were able to demand that they not retaliate against strikers who are just demanding the bare minimum of what any human should expect.
Okay, so what is the current situation now? One thing I wanted to highlight is just I think that one thing that IWOC tries to focus on is really prioritizing and centering the voices of folks inside. And people outside don't need to speak for them, they can speak for themselves. And this was just a really powerful example of how that's happened. The way that the strike happened was that kind of high up folks in internal organizations, which is what the state called gangs, got together and across lines of race and affiliation negotiated the terms of the strike, that it was going to be a peaceful protest, decided on the tactics they would use, and there has just been like a really incredible amount of political unity and discipline across the entire unit that the strike started in, which is like just really remarkable, and we really want to highlight that. And folks on the inside are really advocating for themselves, so I think our role on the outside is really just to like amplify those voices and to try to support the demands that the folks are making for themselves from the inside. So what is the situation now? The strike has ended. It went on for like about a week. All of the workers who struck on the first day were fired after the first day of the strike. At that point, the jail brought in folks from protective custody, which includes people who have snitched, people who are child molesters, other people who need to be separated from the general population to fill in for the kitchen. And also people from the women's side of the jail are being used to kind of like break the strike and fill in those roles as well, which has created this really unstable situation inside the jail. The food is hours late. Folks in general population are really upset that protected custody folks are preparing their food. They don't trust it. The workers have asked the jail for their job back and have received no response, which kind of goes directly against the narrative that the jail and the Board of Supervisors are giving us, that there is no retaliation happening. That in itself is a clear form of retaliation. What else is happening? The unit that started the strike is facing the highest levels of retaliation, so they've been on a modified lockdown since the strike started 2 weeks ago, which means decreased time out of their cells, decreased pod time, less time for showering, for making phone calls,
folks are kind of going stir crazy, and it's just created this really chaotic and very unsustainable situation in the jail that is kind of a big question mark right now how the jail is going to respond to that. So moving forward, this is kind of an important time for us just to keep up the political pressure and make sure that this is kind of like prime time for retaliation after the media attention has kind of died down. So it's an important time to keep up political pressure, increase media attention. We did what we call phone zaps, which is basically putting out to our networks folks to call in to the sheriff's office, the board of supervisors, to express that we want the jail to meet the demands of the strikers, and that they shouldn't be facing retaliation for this peaceful protest. Moving forward, yeah, so it's kind of to be determined how the jail is gonna respond to this situation. Mm-hmm. Folks inside are open to continuing kind of building power of collective action. So we're just kind of trying to figure out right now on the outside how we can best organize ourselves to support those efforts that hopefully will be more upcoming in the future. There's also 4 cases pending against Santa Rita right now. Some are individual cases, some are collective action. There was another case filed this week that addresses all sorts of grievances, also about third-party contractors for food and medical care. So legal action is in the works. It's true. We cannot wait for that. I mean, it's such a dire situation that we really, yeah, Lena is right. We can't wait for the courts to pass down these policies. It really requires immediate action now. So our jail support has really put us in a good position to support these actions from the inside, and has been a really important part of cultivating relationships with people inside, which is like a crucial part of organizing and supporting these actions from the inside. So we accept donations for jail support. It's just providing food, providing rides, providing jackets. So we accept donations of clothing.
Just wanted to comment on some of the things you said that I really appreciated. I reminded about criminalizing sex work, that yeah, prostitutes should be looked at as workers. In fact, I think they said it was the oldest job at one point. Right? Mm-hmm. So look at it as labor and don't criminalize it. And I really like the part in your book where you said that about drug dealers, that if someone who's selling drugs doesn't have a drug problem, they have an employment problem.
That's right.
It's not like they turned down an 80K job at a software company and said, no, I think I'll deal drugs.
Yeah.
And that's how it needs to be looked at. And you talked about the homeless issue. We have a thing in San Francisco, these roving mobile bathrooms with attendants. It has really helped in my neighborhood, Soma.
Wow.
And the people who work there, the social workers, are incredible. Mm-hmm. And they're just so patient. And they say, no, come on, you gotta get out. No, you can't go to sleep in there. You can't shoot up in there. And it's made the streets a lot better in San Francisco in that part. And lastly, I just wanted to say, I think one of the most important things you keep saying, and I think important for all of us to remember, is the idea of short, medium, and long-term strategies. We've got short-term problems we can deal with right now, and medium-term problems, and then long-term. And it can be very hard to, and often long-term solutions can look completely contradictory to short-term solutions. Sometimes they can be extremely confusing. That is one of the most powerful things you said tonight, and that's how we're going to have to address this. And we can get too caught up in both of those, and those two need to be complementary.
Thank you.
Yeah, so people are doing the work here. We just need to plug in to the work that's happening and keep pushing the agenda, keep deepening the analysis, keep pointing out what is next, because that's the only way we're going to get out of this mess.
And that was Alex Vitale, professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College, and also author of End of Policing. If you're interested in purchasing his book is available at Verso Books. I highly recommend people who are involved with police abolition struggle to get very involved with his work and study it, and also be in a conversation with him. This is very important work for both intellectuals and also activists on the ground involved with these struggles. And we would also like to thank Cassie Lopez. She was the woman in conversation with Professor Vitale. She's a longtime activist in the Bay Area, also a public school educator in ethnic studies and Spanish, And she's been a longtime activist in the Communist Party as well. And she also coordinates events for the Nival Proctor Marxist Library in Oakland off Telegraph Avenue. So I highly recommend you guys check out the venue, check out some books over there. Also come for discussions. It's open for everyone. It's all love. Have a lot of love for the Bay Area out here. Also, if you guys are listening into our podcasts on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please leave us reviews. We're trying to look for ways to improve our podcasts. Due to the long delay from our previous episode till now, been in long discussions in our collective of how to make this podcast better. And we'll be having a lot of content coming in the next few months, talking about various struggles and also broadcasting a lot of our events around the country as well. So take a look out for that. We have some webinars coming up. We just did a great one on Martin Luther King's legacy. We have one coming up of Elizabeth Curley Flynn for International Women's Day coming up in March. And I believe our webinar is on March 8th. Please go check it out. The link is on our website at cpusa.org. Also, if you guys are leaving reviews, please leave messages on our Twitter account at CommunistUSA. If you guys have any content that you guys want us to broadcast or talk about, or if anyone's interested in being interviewed, we would love to sit down with you or have you call in and we can make that happen. All right. Thank you guys. Solidarity.